Pretend for just a second you're a successful riverboat captain. You're steaming along in the widest part of the river and suddenly the boat catches fire. You have two choices. You can stop and fight the fire and try to save the boat, but if you lose the fight, the passengers will all die. Or you can turn and run as fast as you can for the shore, knowing that your boat will be lost because of the wind whipping the flames, but hoping to save those passengers. What would you do? Could you afford to make the right choice? A lot of people would make the wrong choice just because they'd face financial ruin from losing that ship. Luckily, legendary riverman Uriah Scott was able to make that choice. And consequently, the death toll from the accident I'm about to tell you about was exactly one. One fellow who just picked a really, really bad time to get drunk. I'll tell you all about it in a second. It's a really interesting episode on the Columbia River. But first, I want to introduce myself. My name's Finn J.D. John. I write a weekly newspaper column called Offbeat Oregon History, and it runs in about a dozen newspapers around the state right now. I've been writing it since 2008. So far, there are about 175 published episodes in the kitty. So every morning, I pull one of those episodes up out of the archive and put it out on the daily RSS feeds. One version in text and pictures for your newsreader, and another version in audio only for your podcatcher. So you probably already know that because you're listening to the podcatcher version right now. Offbeat Oregon History tells the true stories of Oregon history that nobody knows about, the ones that most everybody has forgotten. Stories of heroes and rascals, of shipwrecks and lost gold, of Shanghai'd sailors and Skid Row bordellos and pirates and robbers and buried treasure and unsolved mysteries. Well, today's episode involves a hero and a shipwreck. And it was first published on November 6th, 2011, and I'm going to read it to you now. You might not think a fire on a riverboat would be that big a deal. After all, it's only a river, right? But fire on a riverboat was a very serious matter. The stories of paddle wheel riverboats on American rivers are peppered with tales of fires, and nearly all of them come with a body count. Oregon's most famous riverboat fire has a body count, too. It's one. But it would have been quite a bit higher if it hadn't been for the quick thinking of its legendary skipper. Here's how it happened. When launched in 1884, the Sternwheeler Telephone was the fastest boat on the Columbia, and quite possibly the fastest in the country. With steam up, this rakish and palatial vessel could do considerably better than 20 miles an hour. Its owner, designer, and skipper was the already legendary Uriah B. Scott, the guy who brought true shallow draft riverboats to the Willamette and later ate the lunch of Henry Villard's would-be steamboat monopoly on the Portland-Astoria run with his other steamer, the Fleetwood. The Telephone was even faster than the Fleetwood, and that speed would turn out to be important on one particular voyage, on November 20th, 1887. On that day, the Telephone was steaming toward Astoria as usual when Scott got a terse message over the speaking tube from the engine room.
"Engine room's afire," the engineer reported. "It's driving us away from the engines."
Scott had a choice to make, and he had to make it in the next few seconds. He could muster the crew and try to put the fire out, or he could turn and make for shore at top speed. If he tried to fight the fire, he could possibly save the Telephone. A very valuable piece of naval architecture indeed. And of course, if all went well, he could then continue to Astoria and deliver his passengers as usual. But to do this and have any chance of success, he'd have to kill the engines so that the wind created by the speed of the Telephone wouldn't fan the flames. That meant that if firefighting efforts didn't go well, they'd be stuck in the middle of the widest part of the Columbia River while the boat burned to the waterline and sank. Yes, there would be lifeboats in the water. But people would die. They always did. Decks collapsed under them. They became overcome with smoke. They panicked and jumped overboard and drowned. Or maybe they died of hypothermia in the chilly November river water. There were 140 of them. Some of them would die. And if the crew lost the fight with the fire, the end would come fast. Riverboats like the Telephone were made, of course, of wood. That wood was kept carefully dry to prevent rot and usually pickled in varnishes and flammable paints, which, even after they dry out, help the wood catch and burn and make the smoke deadlier. Captain Scott was an old riverboat man. He knew what happens when one starts to burn. He also knew what had happened to the Eliza Battle a couple dozen years before in Indiana. Efforts to fight that fire failed, and by the time the skipper realized he needed to make for shore, the rudder ropes had burned through and the boat could not be steered. 80 people died on the Eliza Battle, and another 100 were badly hurt while the boat thrashed blindly down the river. Of course, the Eliza Battle was a sidewheeler, which meant that the wind had blown all the flames to the stern and people had to jump off the bow and take their chances with the paddle wheels. But still, if Scott opted to fight the fire, he might save the ship, or he might end up presiding over another Eliza Battle scenario, and if he survived, be forever haunted by the sense of having staked his passengers' lives on a gamble to save his ship, and lost. The alternative was to make for shore with all possible speed. This would involve sacrificing any possibility of saving the boat. The wind created by the telephone's speed would fan the flames to an inferno, and by the time the boat hit the beach, there would be nothing to do but watch her burn. Then, too, it was not clear that the telephone could make it to shore in time. The telephone could hardly have picked a worse place to catch fire. It was most of the way to Astoria when this happened, and the river was almost 5 miles wide. Scott had a good 2 miles of open water to cross, and he had to do it before the fire spread enough to start killing people. Could he make it? Maybe not. Stay and try to save the boat, or run for shore and try to save the passengers? This doesn't seem to have been a hard decision for Captain Scott. He didn't even hesitate. "Put her full speed ahead," he barked back, and put the helm hard a port. The telephone heeled over hard as the paddle wheels thrashing intensified and Scott strained to hold the rudder over. Around the slim vessel came until its nose was pointing straight at the state of Oregon. The engine room black crew, having opened up the steam as wide as it would go, hustled up through the smoke and fire to the top deck, where the passengers were already clustered around the least fiery end of the boat, the one closest to shore. From the pilot house, Scott could look ahead at the patch of deck farthest from the flames, at the very bow of the boat where the wind was sweeping the flames away and back. Soon everything behind and around his pilot house was on fire. The rudder ropes had probably gone by now. In moments, the boat would be fully engulfed, and anyone still on the deck at that time would start dying. But he could see his gamble in making full speed for shore was going to pay off. The telephone was going to make it in time. Nobody was checking, of course, but it's a safe bet that the telephone was moving faster than it ever had before or ever would again. In a few moments, it would be connecting with that riverbank at 20+. The passengers packed into the bow, braced for impact as best they could. Then the telephone fetched up on the Oregon side of the river, traveling at maximum speed. Luckily, there was a gentle mud flat there, and it buffered the impact. Still, the telephone dealt the state of Oregon a mighty blow, and passengers went flying to the rapidly heating up foredeck. There probably were some injuries, the record doesn't say. Whatever those injuries might have been, though, they weren't enough to keep a single passenger on that by now dangerously hot deck once that ship hit shore. Over the gunwales they went, splashing into the water and mud and clambering up on shore to watch the telephone burn. After watching the last of his passengers disembark, Scott turned to leave, but found to his consternation that the fire was surrounding the pilot house and had burned away the steps. So he opened the pilot house window and bailed out. Most sources say he executed a swan dive, but this seems unlikely given that the telephone was stuck in mud. More likely it was something more on the order of a belly flop or cannonball. The telephone burned to the waterline as the passengers watched and firefighters from Astoria did what they could. When all was done, they found a single body in the wreckage, that of an unfortunate fellow who had just picked a really bad time to get drunk and had either passed out or been too befuddled to find his way upstairs. Everyone else made it. The telephone was rebuilt and continued to work the Astoria run for many years after that. It enjoyed a reputation for blinding speed right up until it was scrapped in 1918, but it was never as fast as the original telephone was. Luckily, it never had to be. That's all I've got for you today. You can read any archive column and subscribe to either daily feed by going to the website at offbeatoregon.com. Both feeds are optimized for smartphone use, but they work great on a tablet or a netbook too, or even an old-fashioned computer. All the columns are covered by a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. Well, thanks for listening, and do drop me a line if you're ever in Corvallis and have time for a cup of coffee. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter,
at Offbeat Oregon. Have a great day.